This is the 28th day of February 1990. My name is Robert Williams. I'm visiting today with Mr. Amherst Hardy, a Decatur resident, and we're in the Decatur Public Library for this conversation. Mr. Hardy, you told me earlier that you are a lifelong resident of Decatur up to this point. Could you tell me just a little bit about your early childhood experiences in this community?
Yes. I'm not really an old-timer. Of course, there are plenty of people older than I still around yet, but probably half my high school class of 1928 is still living. But yes, I was born in Decatur in 1911, on West William Street, where I lived until I was 1 year old. I recall nothing about that. My first recollection probably is when my father bought a car in 1915, a Jeffrey. But we took a few trips in that. There were no paved roads in the state at that time. I believe we went to Wisconsin one time and over into Indiana. Trips were pretty dusty, and a good part of the time was spent in changing tires. And 1920, we took a trip to New England, and that went all right, except the car gave out on the return trip. We had to leave it in Cleveland, Ohio. A friend went back and picked it up for us, but nevertheless, we had gone into Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire. And that was quite a feat in those days. Now, from my early recollections, I recall World War I. We, pupils in the first grade of school, we were supposed to bring old clothing and snip it up. For some reason or other, I believe it was to go in pillows for the soldiers. Whether any got there or not, I don't know. And another thing, we were saved nutshells. Those were supposed to go in gas masks. And then at that time, Millikan University had SATC, I believe it was something like it meant Student Army Training Corps. And I remember the barracks buildings on Millikan. At that time, I lived in the 1400 block West Macon, not far from Millikan. And I remember these students drilling, march past the house. And then, of course, my father being on the newspaper, we would they'd run a map in the window with pins where the front lines of the troops were in France. Now, that's my earliest recollection. I went to Dennis School, and I entered it. It had just four rooms and a little over 100 students. And then 3 years in Roosevelt Junior High School and 3 years in Decatur High School on North Franklin Street. My first home room in high school was in the Schellebarger building. That was the old David Schellebarger home. And it was, the old living rooms had been converted into classrooms. It was still standing at the time of my graduation, but torn down a few years later. Now,
Just a couple of questions to probe here. On that trip you took to Maine, that was quite a daring adventure in 1920. You indicated a lot of flat tires, but do you recall at all anything that you might have been used as a guide for finding the right roads that you
made? Yes, yes. They had what they called the Blue Book. It would say, turn right at a tree standing by a church. We were very fortunate. We had no flat tires on that trip, but a party who went with us had 26. Yes, there were no, I think we got into Pennsylvania or New York State where we found macadam roads. We thought that was something great to get off of the gravel. And yes, it was a great trip, but there were no road signs at all, or route markers.
Did you have a blue book for the whole trip, or did you have separate blue books as you went along?
I believe we just had the one blue book. I don't know whether it was an edition for New England or what it was, but it seemed to serve the purpose.
Was it a photo auto guide that had photographs of the places
you
had to turn?
No, it was a huge book with just trees and buildings as guides.
What kind of a car was that?
You that mentioned was the first, the 1915 Jeffrey.
The Jeffrey.
Yes.
Did you recall at all the automobiles were made in Decatur? There were a couple of models that were made.
Yes, there was the Comet, the Pan American. They were, I believe that was before the war. They apparently didn't have much of a market. They soon folded. They were assembly plants, parts shipped in.
Where were those plants located, do you recall?
They were in the northeast part of Decatur. I believe some of the buildings may be there.
Was it the old Houdai Hershey plant?
I believe
Essex
that was one of them, yes. That must have been the Comet.
Did you say these were simply assembly plants? They had the parts manufactured elsewhere?
Yes, they didn't make much here, and the buildings were not, they were not much of a success.
Now, you lived in the west part of town, on West William Street and West Macon Street.
Yeah, West Macon Street is what I remember. We were 1 year old, and those... I believe all the houses in that block are still standing. It was a good neighborhood, but we were really pioneers. The city really ended at the end of our block. And after the war, there were, you'll notice the 1500 block, there's quite a different style of housing there. It's all brick. And
Macon
Street.
I mean, where were the 1500 block?
Taylor Avenue.
Taylor Avenue?
Yes.
Beyond Taylor then was pretty much open country?
That was open country. That opened up then after 1920. Then there was Montgomery Place, which was at the foot of the 1500 block. Was an addition owned by R.R. Montgomery. And there was a pond down there and a bridge. I don't think it's still there, but I don't think anybody notices it as you enter the addition from the 1500 block of Macon Street. There's a little bridge there. Well, where those houses are on Dennis were a pond, a lake. He even had a little rowboat on it. I remember going down there in the wintertime with a group of boys. I I fell through the ice down there. And then my grandfather went down, and he had a rowboat. Mr. Montgomery had a rowboat. And we took it out. I remember my grandfather fell out of the boat. But fortunately, those ponds weren't too deep, and he had a good soaking. But then after that, the town built up to the west quite rapidly.
And the pond was filled in then?
Yes. It just seemed to disappear. I don't remember its passing, but it did go.
You surely remember the West Main Street streetcar line.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about the operation of the
streetcar? If I would go downtown today and see streetcars running, I wouldn't do a double take too fast. It was natural because I took streetcars to school. There were the West Main Street line ended at McClellan Avenue, or really actually went on a little further to serve Fairview Park. Of course, that was the way most local transit systems started. Had a park at the edge of town, and that was usually built by the electric company. Sometimes they called them Electric Park. That wasn't the case with Fairview Avenue, although I understand that Riverside Park, which has been gone for a good many years, was put up by the utility. And they ran lines out there, pick up a little Sunday business. But West Main Street then, that also carried the interurban in from Springfield, would come down West Main Street, and the interurban station was over on Wood Street, about across from the where the courthouse is now, just west of there. So all the interurbans came in there until about 1930, when the another station was built on North End Dyke Street. It's now a Carpenters Union Hall. But the West Main Street line was gradually extended on to Oakcrest, because they had the interurban line, they didn't have to lay any new track, and that was where West William, the extreme end of West William Street, is now. It was a high embankment, but that's been cut down now, but the tracks were on top of that, and the interurban changed it, ended at about Oakcrest. The method was, to come to the end of the line, the conductor would get off and switch the trolley from one end, carry it around, hook it up at the other end, and lower the cow catcher, as they call it. And the streetcars went out. There were a good many lines in town. When I went to Roosevelt Junior High School, I would go to the transfer house and take the Edward Street car. But then there were a good many others that served the east side, the El Dorado, the Condit Line, the North Water Line, and then there's the Riverside Line that served old Riverside Park, also St. Mary's Hospital, and even the old Decatur Country Club, which was at the end of South Jasper Street.
About where South Moreland is today.
Yes, yes, that was a golf course. And yes, the streetcars were a nickel. They finally gave way to buses. We had a bus on West Decatur Street, and streetcar on West Main Street, and the bus was a block closer for me, so I finally switched to that. And then there were some Wildcat buses that came in that weren't owned by the utility. And they went out after a few years.
Were those the jitney buses?
Right
around the same route, right ahead of the regular bus.
Yeah, they were buses, so just slapped together.
Big limousines, big, just big cars.
No, they tried to make buses out of them.
When you went to Decatur High School, you said you graduated in 1928. When you went there, you say your homeroom or one of your classes was in the old Schellebarger home.
Yes.
That was on the corner of El Dorado and Franklin Street,
yes,
wasn't it? It was demolished eventually to make room for the addition on the north part of the school.
The cafeteria was on the second floor of that, too.
It was.
Yeah.
Were you active in high school?
No, I was never active in anything, even in college. I wasn't in sports or anything.
Did you go directly to Millikan? You told me previously you did graduate from Millikan.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about your college experience then?
Well,
you were fairly close to home, weren't you?
Yes, I could walk over there. The president's home was directly across the street from our house, and my father was on the board of managers, and they were very good friends. President Benny, he'd come over to the house, and he had some very enlightening conversations. He was there for 2 years, but in it was, of course, I went to Millikan during the Depression. The enrollment was very low. Probably in the 300s or something, but it was very good. School kept going, all right. What I was going to say about the streetcars, they stopped. They switched over to buses entirely when they put through the subway on railroad subway on West Main Street at Oakland Avenue, and they saw that would disrupt service. I believe that's about 1937, so they took off all streetcars all over town and substituted buses. The bus service then was part of the utility or
Power and Light Company.
Yes.
Were those streetcars double-ended so the motorman could go from one end to the other and operate in either direction?
Yes. Yes. The West Main Street car had a conductor and a motorman for a while. They finally dropped that.
There was a passing track, I believe, right by the Millikan home, wasn't there? You can still see a trace of it in the paper.
The double tracks went out from the transfer house out to the Millikan home, and then single down to Oakland Avenue, and then on the other, right in front of Millikan, there was another passing track, and then picked up again at McClellan, I believe, where the interurbans came in.
The interurbans didn't go to the transfer house, is that right?
They did earlier. They went around it, but I've seen pictures of where people used the transfer house as a boarding point, although the station was actually down at Main and Wood Street, or Water Street, between the two.
When you were at Millikan, did you belong to any fraternal organization?
No, I was not particularly active. Maybe in an English club or something like that.
What was your major at Millikan?
English. Of course, I was at Millikan with the days of football. We had a famous Corbett and Musso, George Corbett and Musso, who later went to the Chicago Bears. But the athletic games were very good for the size of the school.
When did you graduate from Millikan?
1932.
In 32.
Yes.
Did you find it difficult to get work at that time out of college?
Well, of course, my father was on the paper, and I went on to the paper.
What paper was that? Now?
That's the Herald Review.
The Decatur Herald Review.
Yeah. But, yes, a lot of people went into teaching would take jobs at $80 or $90 a month. But they all seemed to do well in later years.
You went to work for your father then in the Decatur?
Yes,
which one?
Well, my father died in 1933, but I had been working odd jobs around the paper and sometimes on the old Herald before the consolidation. I worked as office boy.
Had you worked during your years in college part-time?
No, no, I had done reporting.
Now, your father was the editor
of the old Herald.
Of the old Herald. That was the morning newspaper.
This morning.
And was it at that time separate from the Review?
Yes.
Separate
it was,
ownership?
It was down in the 200 block of Main Street where Good's Furniture Store
North is. Main.
Yes. He came here in 1908. And it's in the news department.
He was a newspaper man then.
Yes, he came out from Massachusetts. He had gone.
Does that account for your first name in
yes,
any way?
Yes, he went to Amherst College.
He went to Amherst College. I wondered if there was a relationship there. And it's spelled A-M-H-E-R-S-T.
Yes. The H is silent.
Uh-huh. Amherst. Well, I probably put the H in when I spoke about it earlier. He came from Massachusetts then to Decatur.
Yes, he was born in Maine.
Uh-huh. That's why you were going back home then on
yes,
that long
trip. Yes, relatives were
in the early
1920s. Back in Maine.
You went to work then as a reporter for the Decatur Herald, did you?
Yes, various.
What kind of a beat did you have?
I guess most exciting was the police beat.
Huh?
They sang around the police station. Of course, we had no drug crime at that time. It wasn't too exciting. But I thought it was. I might say the Prohibition era had ended by that time. It would be nice if you could find some person who knew about that, the life of where the speakeasies were in Decatur.
In Decatur.
Yeah, but I missed that. A lot of my friends knew where to go.
Even as a young college man, you didn't know about that.
No, I didn't know where to go. Everybody else did. I suppose it was something like buying drugs, but not quite as degrading.
Did you, that was in the old courthouse, I suspect, wasn't it, here, when you had your assignment and the police?
Yeah, the sheriff was located in the he had a house next to the old courthouse, and of course the state's attorney and the courtrooms were in the old courthouse. The city hall was had just moved across the street to what is now the Security Savings and Loan. That was the city hall, and the jail was in back of it, and in the rear part. Remember, there was a livery stable next to it that was still operating.
And with horses.
Yes. I forget who the veterinarian was who had it, but Yeah, you'd go over there and I'd be vaccinating pigs right next to the police station. And police radio came in about that time. It was rather a crude affair. It was gradually improved. But they had old radios. The tubes were always falling out of it. So they had to keep a maintenance man there. And I think they had just four squad cars. The sheriff had only six deputies.
For the whole county?
Yes, and they had to divide up. I believe two of them were on nights. They didn't get too many calls.
Were you there, were you living at the time of the last hanging in Decatur, or had that been
I was
before?
In junior high school then, at the time of the John Stacy hanging. I was, Tom was rather excited about that, but that was the last one.
That was at the old courthouse, wasn't it?
Yes.
In the courtyard, kind of?
Yes, and probably at the jail, which was next to it.
Then you say you also were a telegraph editor for, or a telegraph reporter? Is that wire reporter? Is that
yes,
right?
Yes. We had finally paper expanded bought and newspapers in Champaign, East St. Louis, Carbondale, home, and Edwardsville had five papers, and we would get the we had a good news service at all. The Associated Press, Trunk Wire, and the New York Times. And we would set the news there on teletype, and that would automatically, the tape would automatically set the type at the other papers.
Now, you probably got the news in on the Associated Press A-Wire, didn't you, that ran
yes.
about 12 hours?
Yeah, that was, finally, it was a 24-hour deal. Last biggest story was the Kennedy assassination. I believe, of course, the radio and television were right there, and they had a little first, and somebody called me from the newsroom wanted to know about it, and just then it started coming over the trunk wire, and it was a short, when was it? Shortly after noon, and we were about to go to press, so we had to hold things, and that was pretty tight. We got out, I think, around extra that afternoon.
That was about the last extra, I remember.
I believe it was.
Having been published.
We used to have extras for every prize fight. They come out at 10 o'clock at night. Put out an extra, because on the old Herald, the mail edition went to press at 10 o'clock, and so they just run that the rest of the paper and slap the price light on the front page.
How was it sold? We had
newsboys.
Sold?
Newsboys would come in, and they were willing to pick up a few cents.
They'd go out on the street and sell?
Yes, of course there were. To understand, there were no radios, and the prize fight came in over a Morse wire, and the man would, with a megaphone, would read that off and call it out to a big crowd assembled in the street, and then that crowd was still there and was willing to buy the papers. Probably only a few hundred went out, but they were glad to have them. Now, then through baseball, back through the 20s, each newspaper, when they were separate, had a scoreboard for the three major leagues and the 3I League. And then for the World Series, they had in the afternoons, we had a special board set up
them there to record the plays, and that was given out over a megaphone. And my biggest, I guess the biggest day there was the start of World War II, when the news came over the radio Sunday afternoon. I got down to the paper, and about everybody else was there. Of course, the censorship didn't allow too much out on it, but we got out a paper. I don't think we put out an extra, but we had a lot of people. We were the only source of news. See, there was no radio to speak of, or radio news, and no television, and people counted on the newspaper for everything they would hear. They would call the paper, even if something would come over the radio, they would always call the newspaper to verify it.
I'm going to have to stop right here. This is side two of our interview, my interview with Mr. Amherst Hardy on February 28, 1990, here in the Decatur Public Library. Mr. Hardy, I interviewed Mrs. Jane Lee several weeks ago, who had been, I believe, the telephone operator at the Herald and Review, and she, I remember very clearly telling me about how busy she was on the day of the Muequa mine cave-in in Muequa. Were you on the staff of the newspaper at that time?
No, I was not. I was in college then, but my father was on the paper, and I remember that very well. I remember he sent one reporter named Bob Barracks down there, and he was able to get into the mine. I remember he came back and was writing the story, and he had the effects of the coal mine dust on him at that time. Yes, I remember going down to Muequa at that time. I didn't get close to any action, but one of the buildings down there, which is still standing, was used as a morgue. I believe it was around Christmas time in 1932. So that happened. And I remember Jane Lee, the operator, she was the switchboard operator, and she was very, very capable.
Who were some of the more interesting persons you worked with as members of the staff in your recollection over the years?
There was Sam, well, I remember Sam Tucker, who was a columnist for the paper. He was very controversial, and he later went to Washington as a correspondent.
What made him controversial, Mr. Hardy?
Just the views he would take on. Of course, it was during Prohibition. He took a strong stand against Prohibition, and of course, most people thought he was an atheist. And he was an interesting man. And there were the managing editor was Paul Aird.
Who was that, Paul?
Paul Aird, A-I-R-D. He had been on the Old Herald, and he was a very good writer. But yes, no, most of the staff had just short termers. They would start on the paper and leave, go to a bigger paper.
It was a stepping stone.
Yes, but there were some very good men there. Bob Yoder, where he later went to the, well, he wrote some books and some articles in the, he went to the Chicago Daily News, carried on his, had an interesting, humorous style of writing. And he kept that up at the Daily News, and later he did articles in the Saturday Evening Post. And, we had quite a number of society editor, Leah Riggs.
She became somewhat controversial.
She was controversial. I don't know why.
I know one thing. Dealt with the possibility of locating a veterans hospital here in Decatur. You remember that?
Yes, I think. I think Mr. Lindsay had opposed that, and she picked up on that, and that was. Let's see, I don't know whether that was, I think that was before the war, the Second War, and but even so, there was, she ruffled a lot of hairs,
How about Howard Millard?
Oh, yeah, he was sports editor, gave much of his time to the Decatur 3i team, and
he was president of one of the leagues here for a while.
I think he did have an office someplace here, and kept the Decatur team going. It's pretty hard to do. Of course, it finally folded long after his death. And, Milliken liked him. He promoted the Milliken Sports. And kind of an interesting writer. But his writing was different from what we have today.
We spoke on the phone about H. Allen Smith. Do you recall anything at all about him, the American humorist?
I've read his books. He lived over here on East El Dorado Street, and I didn't know about him being in Decatur until I read his books, and he had some connection with St. Patrick's Church, and I went to school, St. Patrick's School, and wrote about Father Murphy.
I was thinking he worked for one of the Decatur newspapers. You don't recall that?
I don't recall
that
he worked with the papers at all. You may have.
The kind of newspaper plant that you worked in was the old hot lead press operation,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
Did you work at all in production?
No. The time I remember in the very old days when they had the Morse wire, and the Heralds put on the United Press, which had the first teletypes. And then we started having the teletype center, which, well, we had the old linotype operators in the composing room. We'd have the teletype operator with the typewriter keyboard going much faster in the editorial department. That I believe right up until the last we had some linotypes, and even the teletypes gave way to computers after my time.
Did you experience any real hardship during the Depression years? You were in Decatur at that during the Depression years.
No, I lived with my family, I started out. One of my jobs was as a bill collector for the paper, collecting for unpaid classified ads, and I learned the town that way by going all over the town. Nobody had any money, and my collections were very sparse.
The Roosevelt New Deal program, of course, came along during that period and embarked on a lot of public works programs in all around the United States. Can you recollect any of those programs that were here in Decatur?
I didn't happen to cover any offices, but yeah, we had all these alphabetical agencies, WPA, PWA, which built the Kintner Gymnasium at the high school. And of course, as we were talking about Sam Tucker, he was very strong on the New Deal.
And, Pro-New Deal, he was?
Oh, yes, he was. That was great. And even went down to Washington and he thought FDR was a great president and got pretty close and was always promoting anything that came from that office. But what went on here, I think we had a CCC camp, the Civilian Conservation Corps, located here. They did some work in the parks. And it was the WPA that took up the streetcar tracks. When the streetcar stopped running, there were still tracks all over town, especially downtown, and they took the tracks up. They were very efficient at it. So they got going. They could get take a block in no time at all.
Do you remember the old wooden block pavements in parts
of downtown?
Oh, yes. Where were those located?
West Prairie Avenue. Well, in fact, they all through downtown. And West Prairie Avenue had them. And my father may have been responsible for getting them here. They seemed to work in Springfield, Massachusetts, where he came from, and he thought they would work here. And I don't know. Of course, he didn't. I don't think he had anything to do with putting them in, but he didn't oppose them. But it seemed that the frost here was severe enough to uproot them, and we'd have a rainstorm, and they'd float away. that was an unpleasant chapter in the history.
I remember those episodes.
Yeah.
Was the purpose to make it easier on horses' hooves, quieter?
No, I don't think so. The automobile had come in pretty well when they started laying those blocks. Before that, we just had the brick pavement.
You indicated that you did have experience during World War II, military experience during World War II. Is that correct?
Yes.
You were working at the newspaper at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yes, and I was in the Navy about 3 months later and stayed for 4 years. And so I didn't know too much. I did get the paper while I was away and kept in touch with the city that way, but I know they had shortages of help on the paper. They started hiring women at that time.
As reporters?
As reporters. It hadn't That was it. Yeah, it had been an all-male bastion up until then, although they had women in the society and departments, plenty of women around the paper, but not as reporters. So, yeah, took over and were very, very good, if you could keep them.
Did you volunteer for the Navy, or were you?
Yes, the Navy was volunteer. There was no
that's
naval
right.
draft.
There was no draft, was there?
So I went in as a radio man, and let's see, I believe it was almost the end of. Well, I left San Diego after finishing radio school and went up to San Francisco, where our ship was still being built, and wasn't finished until the end of the year, or a little after that. And it was what we call a hospital evacuation ship, and we went out to Pearl Harbor. That was a year after the attack. And then down to, took Marines down to Guadalcanal, and then for the next 6 months, we ran between the Solomon Islands and New Zealand. And
evacuating the wounded and the injured and taking them to hospitals in New Zealand?
Yes, weren't. And bringing in fresh troops was probably most of it at that time. But I was subject to seasickness, and down there in the roaring 40s, I didn't last very long. So they put me on a destroyer tender, repair ship, at Espirito Santo in the New Hebrides. I was there for a year. And came back and was at the Naval Air Station as a radio operator. And for a few months, but I put in for a commission. And then early in December of 1944, I was sent to training in Hollywood, Florida for 2 months, and came back and was in the amphibious forces at the Pearl Harbor. And from there in August, we left for Japan. The war hadn't ended, but it ended as we were crossing the date line, August 15th. But we went on to Japan and landed troops there.
You would have been involved in an eventual invasion of Japan if the Japanese had
invasion.
Had you had experience with ham radios before you went into the Navy?
Not much. I had a friend who was, but I am now. I'm not a ham, but I'm still interested in radio. I have a shortwave radio and a lot of police scanners. I've left the interest there.
What sparked your interest in going into? Did you have a chance to choose your special field in the Navy?
Yes, you could put down. While I was in college, a close friend was a ham operator. It was very primitive in those days. You had to build your own equipment, even down to the battery charger. And I never got into the technical side of it in the Navy, but I always kept up that interest when I got out, and still do listen in on the hams, take the Morse code up to about 18 words a minute. And the thing is, I don't believe the Navy has radio operators anymore. It's all computerized, and even the hams are computerizing too. They get their stuff on it, prints out on a computer. Mm-hmm. No more
Can you still read Morse code?
I can read about 15 or 18 words
you
a minute.
Still can.
I try it every day.
Do you?
Yeah, I can.
You can pick it up on your shortwave radio then, can't
yes,
you?
Yes,
keep in practice.
When I was in the Navy, I had to do it on the typewriter, but now I can take it down by pencil pretty well. So I try the typewriter sometimes.
When you sailed out of San Francisco on that first trip with your newly outfitted ship, going to, I think you said, went to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I went down to San Diego, and I think took on 1,000 Marines there. And interestingly enough, there was some space left on the ship. We took on, I've heard, up to 65,000 cases of liquor for the officers' club in Pearl Harbor. And it was some.
Did it get there?
they lost, I think, 1,000 cases, but they said insurance automatically allowed for that.
Well, in that crossing, you say this is about a year after Pearl Harbor. Did you have to operate on radio silence on that?
Oh, yes. We never transmitted in our ship.
You use flash signals, I suppose, if you ever saw another ship.
If we were in a convoy of ships, they'd use flags or usually flashing light. Yeah.
But you had to be very careful about radio transmissions at that time.
Yes. On the ship I was transferred in to on the New Hebrides was a radio station, and they had, I never did it, but they had speed key operators who, because we didn't move, we just stayed in the harbor and were stationed, and he kept up communications with other stations in the South Pacific.
Now, that evacuation ship was not a true hospital ship, so you could legally then carry troops.
Three-inch guns and a five-inch, and we were armed. And I left the ship, and it never came back. Never had any relief. It went on up into near Okinawa, was finally hit by a kamikaze right in the radio shack. It killed, I think, 37 on the ship, including my best friend who had gone up from third-class radio man up to chief. And here is really good.
You came back after the war was over. Did you go to work for the newspaper again
then?
Yes,
yes, anyway.
And continue to work for the Decatur. This was the combined Decatur Herald and Review by that time.
Yes.
Until your retirement.
Yes.
Who were some of the editors that you worked with then after the war, and that period of time after the war?
Well,
that
I
you
probably
can recall?
Should mention the columnist David Feltz. He was a very brilliant man. He and Sam Tucker had worked together, but when Sam left for Washington, he took over. And of course there was, I remember when Burl Engelman, I was a reporter, when Burl Engelman came back in the 1930s, his father had been superintendent of schools here, and we were more or less old friends, and I don't know any others.
Otto Kyle, there was
Otto
Kyle.
Otto Kyle was editorial writer on the Review. His son was sports editor, took over.
Was that Forrest?
Forrest took over from Howard Millard later on. On an afternoon newspaper, you had to get down pretty early in the morning. And sports was the first thing out because there had been beings the night before. Nothing was developing, so the first 2 hours on the telegraph wire were always sports. And, the sportsmen, they stayed on for quite a while. And,
what kinds of changes have you found in the community here that have been most profound as you look back over your years here? In the physical makeup of the town or anything else that you might...
Yeah, the downtown buildings didn't change for a long time. And finally, it seems just the last few years the town has changed. The old schools have gone. For a while it didn't look like it would ever change, but they built up buildings. And the main thing is the personnel. You used to see a building, a shoe store. You knew who the manager was, or the owner. He was a prominent man in town. Now they just bring in a... They're all in chain stores, and they bring in a young fellow from out of town and ship him on to another store. Now, the penny store, I remember talking to R.C.M. Crobble, was manager of it, and he told me once while other stores in that operation changed managers every few years. He was here for life, and was very active in the community. And that's the way even the banks have, you always knew, maybe you didn't know him personally, but the president of the bank was a prominent name. Now you probably wouldn't know any of them. Or a theater manager, or any manager downtown.
Who was the theater manager at the Lincoln Theater? It was there for so many years. Do you recall? Just theaters in general. Could you tell us anything? Tell me anything at all about the old moving picture theaters downtown?
Yeah,
how
there
they
was
made
the
change.
The Lincoln Theater was. After it was taken over by Bellamy and Katz, really imitated the Chicago theaters. They had twin organs, and of course they were, even had matinees, and they were quite an asset to the downtown. I remember one of the department store wanted to move from Water Street over to near a theater, and the store solicited funds for moving to cover the expenses, and the theater was only too glad to give. Brought women in for the matinee shows. Talking pictures, I believe. There was the Empress Theater, which was vaudeville. As a young boy, I went there. I guess I liked the live entertainment. Mm-hmm. And they would have about six or eight acts, and then sometimes a short movie on that. But in the Lincoln Theater, in its early days, tried to bring one stage a show a month here with a leading actor or actress, brought some closer to the theater. And it would serve too as concerts that Milliken would bring, or the music club. And I remember too, as a young boy in the third or fourth grade, the Symphony Orchestra, I believe it was in Minneapolis, would come here, and the schools would get a special rate to come down in the afternoon and hear the orchestra.
Did you go to the circus?
Yes, there were circuses here. I never could figure out where they were. They were up in the north part of town somewhere, maybe in carnivals, too. They would come with their rides. It may have been, well, in the Elm tradition or east of there in the Brennan tradition. I never figured out where they were. But they were always interesting. The newspaper always usually got passes with circuses and carnivals. My father would get them, and we'd have a pretty good time at them.
As a part of the advertising, probably.
Yes, yes.
In exchange for some of the advertising in the newspaper.
And even the theaters gave out passes to the newspapers.
That's right, and the newspapers would pass some of those on to their carriers for doing a good job, I recall.
Yeah, that was right. For the circus, I remember circus press agent coming into town and out of the paper, and the first thing he did was get hold of the circulation manager. The circulation manager put high pressure on for tickets for the carriers.
Well, Mr. Hardy, we're just down to the last minute here. It's been a very delightful hour that I've had a chance to spend with you here conversing. I'm very grateful to you for giving your time, and I know that the people here in the library will also appreciate this. Your comments will go on file in the local history room, and I'm sure that others will listen to or read about your comments will gain some new insights on what Decatur was like during your growing up and work experience.
I might say that when I started on the paper 40 or 50 years ago, one of the Mr. Banton, whom I worked with on history, suggested that we interview some of the older people here. If we'd done that, we'd been 50 years up on history. We've got some good pioneer stories. Too bad we didn't do
it. It's too bad we didn't have tape recorders 50 years ago to get all these things down. Well, thank you again, Mr. Hardy, very much.